Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my absolute pleasure to have as my guest one of my favorite authors, Kent Nerburn. Kent Nerburn is the author of Lone Dog Road and 15 other books on spirituality and Native American themes. He has been praised as the one writer who can bridge the gap between Native and non-Native cultures. Kent has twice won the Minnesota Book Award. His book, Chief Joseph and the Flight of the Nez Perce, was a New York Times bestseller and is internationally acclaimed Neither Wolf Nor Dog, which was the one book South Dakota selection for 2019, is used in multicultural curriculums around the world. Kent is currently serving as the cultural liaison to the International Smile Network in their work providing dental and cleft palate surgeries to children on the reservations in South Dakota. Kent is widely recognized as one of the earliest advocates for the Own Voices movement. He founded an award-winning multiracial, multicultural newspaper in Minneapolis to give voice to the voiceless and created an oral history project on the isolated Red Lake Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota, where students sat at the feet of the tribal elders to hear and collect their stories. And with that, Kent, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me. That's a big suit of clothes that you laid out there that I'm supposed to fit into, but I'll give it my best. I never recognized that guy when I hear reduced to that, but you know, hey, if it's all legitimate, it's all good stuff, and I'm happy to have gotten to where I am in life and happy to talk about it.
Yeah, one of the things we talked about just before we went on, before we started to record, is like with your body of work, I think 39 books, 35 years of really working in Native cultures, representing their stories, it was like, where do we start? And fortunately, Kim, your publicist for New World Library, sent me a good list of questions and really wanted to focus on your newest work, Lone Dog Road, and talk about that, see where that goes. So I have read the book. It is a marvelous story. You're a master storyteller, and it's just a book that I think renews hope in the collective good of mankind. So thank you for the work that you put forth and just for the work that you do in general to improve the state of humanity in this world.
Well, you know, when I tell people, you know, basically we've got to pay our rent for our time on Earth, and how you choose to do it is, it doesn't have to do, to my mind, with economic success or external moments and external significance. Sometimes it's just a single moment. I mean, when you first contacted me, I think it was about the cab driver story. Yeah, the story about when I was driving a cab, such as the life of anyone in the arts, you get by as you can. I was driving a cab in Minneapolis, and I picked up a woman, a strange call in the middle of the night, and said she wanted to be picked up. And I thought, this was odd. Why did she want to be picked up in the middle of the night? And she came out, and long story short, she was, and her doctor said she had to go to a hospice. I don't understand why that was, because in retrospect, I don't even know that hospices was a term at the time. It was in the late 80s. But the point being that I drove her around the city. She said, she said she was going to this hospice. And I suddenly realized this was the last place she was, last time she was going to be out in the public and in the world. So she said, can we drive her on to the old places where I used to live? And I said, sure. I shut off the meter and drove her around all of the Twin Cities and anywhere she wanted to go, and let her off at the end of the journey at this, I remember driving under this portico in this little suburb outside of Minneapolis, and she got out and gave me a big hug and said, thank you. You gave an old woman a little bit of joy on her last ride. And like at that point, it was one of those moments where I said, you know, maybe this is why I was on Earth. This is how, maybe this moment is the moment that I, there was where I paid my rent for my time on Earth. And we all have it. We all look for it. And, you know, to look for big, significant things is one thing, but to find the small moment where you were there at the right time and did the right thing, that's what matters to me. So I just look at it as, you know, I've had good fortune. I stumbled into being a writer. It wasn't what I intended to do. But once I did it, I said, my job is to speak as authentically and as much from the heart as I can about the subjects that I choose to write about.
And speaking from the heart, I think, is more impactful than just any technical knowledge we could have about a topic. If people can see our passion for what we're writing about or for what we're talking about, it's going to get other people excited. And it's going to create a community of like-minded individuals who are interested in, you know, leaving their mark on this world and making the world a better place. Also, I had another story that had resonated, and I may have mentioned this in the email when I initially contacted you, was Candles on the Grave. That is a story that I used to share regularly with the bereaved parent support group that I facilitated. And the thing that I loved about that story is, as a parent myself who has experienced, and I call it the transition of a child to a new existence, you captured so beautifully the experience of what it was like for a parent to have lost a child without having, you haven't gone through that yourself. And it was just incredible. You were able to capture it just so accurately and with so much empathy and compassion. And it just drew me in. And it's a story that, an essay of yours that I refer to over and over and over again.
Well, you want us to give a little synopsis of it, and then I'll talk a bit about it.
Yes, The Candles on the Grave. This is where you had been watching a woman. It was in your hometown of Minnesota. You went by a particular cemetery every day, and you saw a woman who was actually cleaning the grave, tending to the grave. And you went, and you, when she wasn't there, to take a look, and it was a child that had died, and there was a series of toys that were arranged in kind of a very symmetrical fashion. And you would eventually talk with her and ask her to tell you about her son. And you just did it again with just so much compassion and empathy and presence. And I remember her saying to you, there are so many graves that go untended. I'm paraphrasing this. I wish we could put a candle on every grave.
And that was, you know, this sort of ties into what I was just saying about finding the moment, the moment of significance in our insignificant lives. I was living in a small town, I think it was 13,000 people, a little college town, northern Minnesota, 100 miles from a freeway, 100 miles from the Canadian border. And you would think that there's nothing of significance that you could write about or that's going to take place. But I was driving down the road and saw out of the side of my eye this grave that, or in the cemetery, there were all these spinning wheels and shiny objects. And it's a very staid cemetery in a very conservative little town. And I went over there and I kept driving by. And then one day I saw that there was a woman sitting, she was sitting by the grave and she was reading something to it. And I said, oh my God, what is this? You know, this is there's some tragedy here that I can hardly even bear to think about. Because I, like every parent, I mean, if you've experienced it, I haven't experienced it. I cannot imagine what it is to lose a child. I've said, if one of my kids died, I'd probably walk out the door and start walking until I came to the end of the earth. I wouldn't know what to do. But I've talked to people who survived that, and they said, you don't have a choice. You go on. You go on. You don't get to leave. Not knowing what I was seeing, I just kept going by. One day, I said, I should probably stop and talk to her. I didn't actually. I wrote it as a mother, but it turned out she was the grandmother. The cemetery people would come and take away the things that she put on the grave. You know, she had a little baseball cap of his. A lot of those days were McDonald's toys, things like that. She would put them on the grave. And she, you know, when I started talking to her, she talked about him in the present tense. And she had a picture of him. And I said, you know, something here is so pure. Then she started talking about the other people. You know, there are these other graves. No one cares about them. And so ultimately, this is an example of one of those moments that you just get lucky. I said, you know, I got to do something for this woman. So this is not in the book or anywhere other than somewhere back in the archives of my blog. I just wrote and said, does anyone want to contribute to getting a tombstone for this little guy? Because she didn't have any money. She lived in a trailer on the outskirts of town. And we put together a couple hundred dollars, and then she and I went down to a town 100 miles away, and they picked out a tombstone and put it on his grave. And it's one of those things you say, damn it, I did the right thing that time. And it's not, well, you know, I just gave it an example of two times when I did the right thing, and out of the 10,000 when I didn't do the right thing. And more often than not, it's not doing the wrong thing. It's failing to do the right thing when it's there. But it's, again, an example of something, just a little moment in an extraordinary opportunity and an extraordinary moment in a tremendously ordinary life. And, I mean, we all have them. You know, we just have to grab them when they come by.
Okay. Well, and your essay really honored not only my path as a parent who'd experienced the death of a child, but any parent that I've talked to has experienced that path. And it was just greatly appreciated that you took that time and you saw that as one of the moments where, hey, we can make a difference.
Well, and that's, again, you know, writing is a very strange, it's a strange profession in a million different ways. And I'm sure working the way you do, you know, behind the microphone and broadcasting to people that don't know you, or know you, but you don't know them. You know, you get to know them a little bit by coming back at you, but ultimately there's an imbalance between you as the person they see and them as the group that you speak to. And a writer, the sense of satisfaction is very abstract. That's part of the reason I got involved with this Smiles Network of dealing with, you know, kids with dental needs on the reservations, because you get a lot of praise. You know, if you get known at all, if you get this tiny bit of celebrity, maybe you get a great amount of celebrity. I got just enough that someone calls me up and says, you want me to be on your podcast? But, you know, it's not like I walk down the street and someone says, oh, there's this guy, there's Nurburn. But your sense of satisfaction is abstract. When I taught, I understood more about the immediacy of a response. And if you go out and you serve in some way, you get an immediacy of response, but you don't get it as a writer. I like to say you're in a glass box and you're shouting as loud as you can. And you see all these people walking by out there, but you don't know whether they're hearing you, whether it's connecting in any way. And so if you happen to get a bit of a sound through that wall, a shaft of light, and someone says, I experienced that, thank you, you felt me on my journey, then you say that was worthwhile. But you don't know it. You don't know it. It's such a strangely insular life. And you know, it takes a certain type of temperament to do it, because the people do think that you have more, you know, that, like I said, they know you. You don't know them. And ultimately, I'm sitting in a room, sitting at my computer, wondering if I have anything left to say, anything new to say, and hopefully looking for the moments when I get the gift of something that I can tell a story about, or tell it, or use as a teaching tool, because teaching is what it's all about for me.
Yeah, and I think also the greatest teachers are sometimes the best students as well, too. And, you know, the mantra of the podcast is we're all students and teachers, so let's learn from each other. And
absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, teaching is about building relationships. And I saw the interview you did, I think it was at the Red Lake Indian Nation with your former student.
Oh, scary, sure.
It was Gary, and that was a great interview. I smiled, I think, through probably 99% of it. Yeah. But I could tell that you had built up such a relationship with him and the other children and young adults and at Red Lake that they valued your presence. And I think if we can build good relationships with those people around us, they're willing to accept our presence. They're willing to accept and at least listen to what it is we have to say. Mm-hmm. And it's all about building relationships first, beyond the teaching piece.
Right. Yeah. And I thought that, you know, that was a point for those of you listening. I was invited back to the Red Lake Reservation, where I initially had done my work. I had taught for 3 or 4 years and eventually got fired and thrown out, which happens to people on reservation, white people on reservations all the time. And in fact, almost by necessity, it's almost the right thing that it should happen, because then the native people pick up the mantle and go forward. But I had these students and I struggled with what a teacher's job is. I know how to teach when I'm writing. If you notice in all my books, with the exception of probably the last one, Lone Dog Road. My way of teaching is saying, come along with me. We're going to go on a journey together, and I'm going to show you what I see, and maybe we'll talk about it a little bit, and I'll tell you what I saw. And if it helps, then I've done my job. But it's always fellow travelers. Picking up the woman in the cab, it's about you're coming with me, and look what happens. We're walking, going by the graveyard. We're driving down the road together. Look what happens. It's not me stepping out and speaking and saying, ex cathedra, you know, this is what you should know. And so on the reservation, you know, I struggled with it because the balance between being an authority figure and a friend, I mean, I think every teacher has to figure out how to do that. And how much do you want them to find their own way? And how do you make that happen? And how much do you want to tell them, no, you're going down a wrong path and you're going to do it this way? And I think I overbalanced towards being a friend. But the elders told me that what was important in teaching the students is to build a learning family, you know, build a family. And so I got back up there this last, just a couple of weeks ago. And five of the students that I hadn't seen for, they hadn't been together for 30 years, all of them. They lived in different places. And they got together, and we hadn't seen each other. They hadn't seen each other. And it was warm. And it made me say, I probably did it right. But I didn't know at the time. Absolutely, I didn't know at the time. And I think back, I probably overreacted and overbalanced in favor of the being a friend rather than an authority figure. But ultimately, you have to hope that you're being a meaningful mentor, and if you make mistakes, you reveal that's part of your humanity. That, you know, you make mistakes, I make mistakes, and come, let us embrace and try to move forward. And that was it. So much fun talking to them. I told my wife at the time, right, that if someone said to me I could stand on a stage at Carnegie Hall or at Lincoln Center, or I could be up here at Red Lake right now, I'd say I'm going to Red Lake, because it was just that warm having those friendships and those moments.
Yeah, and it was obvious that you were in your comfort zone there, and you just really, it was like talking to an old friend you haven't talked to for years, but when you revisit the old friend, it's like you pick up where you left off. I know the interview you talked a bit about Lone Dog Road, so let's get into that for a bit.
Sure.
Tell us about your book, Lone Dog Road. What inspired you to write it?
Well, it's one of those things where I can go back a long way and a lot of different tributaries that come together to produce the book, but there are two that I think are really significant. And the first one is that I consider it my elder book. You get to a certain age, and one of the things that I've really taken to heart from dealing with Native people is that the elder has a certain responsibility. You know, we're raised in a sort of a linear sense of our time in life. You know, you're a child, you become an adult, and you have your period of productivity and economic activity and influence and fecundity, and you raise your children, and then you gradually go into a period of quiescence and rest. Sure, fine model, but not the Native model. The Native model is there are four seasons of life, and only the one in the last season has seen all the three previous seasons. So there is a wisdom in the last season of life that you are responsible for sharing. And each person has a different wisdom. A lot of times people that have had the worst and most difficult lives and seemingly most insignificant lives have the most wisdom to share because they've watched the process. They've watched themselves. They've watched their friends. And you reach that point where you need to give back. So it was my time to give back. And so what do I give back? What do I have to offer? Which brought up the second thing. And that was the arrival of the pandemic. The pandemic dovetailed on a number of things that it was a confluence, a perfect storm of some cultural realities. I won't go off into the Trump world, but there were a lot of anger. I mean, a lot of anger, a lot of adversarial approach to interaction, dominance, fighting. We were all angry. We were all scared from the pandemic. You're going into, what is this? Is there something floating in the air? And if it gets to me, is going to kill me. So we retreated to this kind of isolation. And then the third thing was like, I'm here in Minneapolis, and the George Floyd killing took place. And at that moment, voices rose up and said, you haven't been listening to us. And the whole Own Voices movement came. You haven't been hearing us. We black men have not, no one's listened to us. The women, no one has listened to us. My wife works with doing memoirs with mostly older white women. No one listened to them. And everyone started claiming the right of their own voice to be heard. And I really accept this. And I think that's absolutely essential. Old white guys, we have held the stage. But it became clear that other voices need to be heard. No one was listening to anyone else. Everyone was, you have to listen to me, you have to listen to me, you have to listen to me. And so I said, okay, my elder responsibility here is to give voice to many different approaches to understanding the world, and yet, individual isolations, but somehow the commonality that we have at heart. There is our individuality, our cultural specificity, but at the same time, everybody who's lost a child is the same person. Everyone who, you want to love, you want to be loved, you want your kids to have more happiness than sadness in life. There's a common human urge towards goodness and community. The commonality was really running across purposes with the individuality and the sort of cultural balkanization. So I wanted to write, as my senior book, I wanted to write a book that spoke to this. And I wanted to do it at a time. I want all the characters to be characters who I loved. And I wanted to be in a setting that I loved. And my whole background has been working with Native American people and Native American values. And I love the Dakotas. It's strange. We all fall in love with certain places that people might scratch their head and say, why? Well, for me, the Dakotas have a magic, and that's a subject unto itself, but they have a magic. So I set the book in the Dakotas and pretty much put out a series of different people, from two little guys, one who's 11 and one who's 6, and the 6-year-old they call him neurodivergent, I guess, but ultimately then that isn't the way the Native people see those. They see them as if there's someone who's outside the normal patterns of things. There's a certain sacredness in it. Two little guys, there's a middle-aged white guy, sort of the typical American man searching for meaning, not quite knowing how to get it, who, of course, is set on his journey because his dog died, and dogs are important to me, and a series of other Native people, Native women, and a black traveling singer who, that was in some ways a high-risk character, but I just felt like doing it. I knew someone like this. I knew a number of black people, and I liked black people of black cultures, and I think I have learned over the years to be a good listener and to be able to inhabit these people with an authenticity. So that was my book. I wanted to tell the story of these two little boys who are set on a journey, love road books, love the road, just said the metaphor for our lives, set on a journey to go across the Dakotas to western Minnesota, where all the pipestone, sacred pipes get their stone for Native people all around North America. So it's the story of their journey and the people that they meet. And it was a challenge. It needed to be a redemptive book, and it needed to have a book of hope, because I just don't see enough. I don't feel enough hope in America right now. I don't like the path we're on. I think we've missed some things along the way. I think Native values have a great deal to teach us. And instead of writing an angry book, instead of writing a book that spoke to irreconcilable differences and isolations, I wanted to set these people out like the fingers on a hand. And at the end, the hand becomes one. So it was a challenge, a long book, a very sprawling book, and really an homage to the American road book. I love road books, and this was just one more road book. I like to call it, if you want to give it a $3 title, you can call it a spiritual road mystery. But ultimately, it's a couple little guys trying to find a piece of pipestone and meeting interesting folks on their journey.
Yeah, and it was you had so many diverse voices, so many diverse individuals. And I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, you know, you used a first person narrative approach. Mm-hmm. And I think I understand why, as far as, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was important for everybody to have their own unique voice, to be empowered so that they could share what they were seeing from their own lives and how they saw their own lives intersecting with the two young Lakota boys. You wanted that to be authentically in their own voices. Am I correct or am I?
No, absolutely. I mean, all of this really ties together, you know, in that, well, like doing the oral history project on the reservation with the kids, the idea was to let the elders speak, get their words down. Running a community newspaper in sort of a multiracial part of Minneapolis, let the voices speak, get out of the way. And always as a writer, I'd let myself be present as a narrator or had a narrator. And it's a very big risk to absolutely have no narrator, but just to have individual voices. But I wanted to pull myself out of the way completely. And this came from a very odd place in my childhood. My father was a director of disaster services for the American Red Cross in Hennepin County here in the Twin Cities. And that meant his job was to go out whenever there was any sort of a disaster, a fire, a flood, an airplane crash. It didn't matter. His job was to go out and provide clothing, shelter, food, whatever, to the people who were impacted by this. And my dad and I, you know, I love my dad, but he was a pretty wounded man and really couldn't express his emotions real well. And what we did, he would, so I liked to do things with him. That was our way of sharing our love for each other. He would come into my room, knock on the door in the middle of the night and say, "Kent, you know, there's a four alarm on the north side. You want to go with me?" And sure, I'll go with you, Dad. And so from about the age of 12 up to about 15 and 17, here I am living in this little suburban reality of mine, worrying about whether or not, you know, some girl is thinking I'm cool or whether I have a new pimple on my face. And I get called out in the middle of the night and get in the car with my dad and find myself in some setting of some horrific event. The one I remember most vividly was getting taken to a lake nearby us where there had been a drowning. And the woman, the mother of the boy, probably my age, maybe that's how I remember it, it's dark. She's sitting on the beach on the far side of the beach by herself, huddled in a blanket. And I'm over there by myself on the other side of the beach while my dad is providing coffee to the people who are dragging the lake for this body. I can see them sitting out on the, going back and forth on this little boat with this little tiny motor in the darkness and the shining flashlight on the water and dragging with this grappling hook, which is really just a big 3-4 prong probes. And all of a sudden, the guy says, "We got something." And they pull it up and they pull up this body, this bloated body of this little 8, 10, 12-year-old kid. And the cry that I heard from the mother on the other side of that beach, I'll never not hear that cry. So then I get back, he gets done. The body's taken away. The lights are shut off. The boat's taken away. And my dad, we get back in the car. We drive home. I get back in my bed, wake up the next morning. And, well, let's see. I've got this pimple I'm worrying about, and my belt isn't very cool, and I can't get my hair. And it was like a whole time when I should have been developing my own personal identity, I didn't matter to me. What mattered to me was the other. The other mattered to me much more than I mattered to myself. Writing a book like Lone Dog Road allowed me to have the other matter more than I did. I could understand. I've got a good capacity for empathy, whether it was built into me, whether I learned it, I don't know, but luckily I've got a strong capacity for empathy with other people's situations. So I just wanted to give each of these people their own voice, and I wanted them to be intimate. And someone was telling me that the thing they liked about the voices is the people spoke as if they were speaking to them. Not projecting, not broadcasting anything. They're speaking closely to you from the heart. And so that was really why I wanted to do it that way. Get myself out of the way and take a chance on a literary technique that really is, it was risky. You don't know whether all those pieces are going to fit together. And also, as a writer, I don't always know where I'm going. Well, I should say that in general, I don't know where I'm going. I set the characters loose and writers say this all the time, but until you actually experience it, you can't realize how absolutely true it is. You don't know what those characters are going to do. I can create my setting. I love my settings. The setting is always a character in my books. I love the land. I love the weather. I had South Dakota. I see it. I can put it on the ground, and then I can paint the picture, and then I'd put the characters in it, and they'd say something to each other. Another one would say something back, and before long, they're moving on this journey, and I did not know where they were going to end up. And luckily, that it was a pandemic, all I had was them as my friends. You know, my wife was, the two of us, and, we'd sit across the yard from someone else, and we're all wearing our masks and talking over a fire in the yard, a bonfire, but we didn't have any real human interaction. So these were all my friends, and I wanted them to do well. So that was why, I wasn't there. It was them. It was their journey. And it was a wonderful way to create a book, but I didn't know whether it was going to work or not.
I mean, it worked for me. I felt like all the individual characters you created in the first-person narrative were talking directly to me. I felt like I knew them. I had a very intimate relationship with them. And I think one of the key points you brought up is the ability for the need for us to establish ourselves as listeners. Yeah. I tell my students at Utica University, if you're going to work with a client who's having a variety of different challenges, the only way you're going to get the full picture is if you listen first. Listen, get the full story, take some time to reflect, get permission from that individual to share some observations about things that they perhaps need to work with and make it a collaborative relationship. But if we're not listening and we're talking, we don't get the full picture.
Right. And that was one of the, when we were doing the oral history project with the Red Lake Ojibwe, one of the elders I took the kids out to, he tried to actually teach them. You know, he had them at his feet, and this was a chance for him to teach. And he said, the first lesson you have to learn is to listen. It's the lesson we had to learn as children, that ability to be present to the world around you is your most important task. And I think so much of the time we instinctively listen to another person and are formulating our response to what it is that they're saying while we're listening. But ultimately, good listening is not doing that. It's letting be absolutely present to what that other person is saying. And then, yes, at the end of that, if you have something to say in response, maybe what you say augments what they say. Maybe it's just to bring out more. Maybe it's to tell a story of your own that somehow has some analogy to it. But ultimately, the second, the old guy, Amos Lone Dog, in Lone Dog Road, says that at one point when I start to interrupt him, he says, don't interrupt me. He said, if you start interrupting me, that means you're thinking about what it is you want to say in response to what I'm saying. I don't want you thinking about what you have to say. I want you to just hear me right now. And so I have the character of Danton sort of back up and say, okay, now I just have to listen. I mean, listening, I think it's probably the most essential and underrated skill that we have in these times. Because people are shouting at each other. People aren't listening to each other. People are twisting what the other person says. And as you start developing listening skills, it's not just listening to words. It's listening to spaces. It's listening to tonalities. It's listening to hitches and hesitations. You're hearing a whole person, not just the words they say. But it's an acquired skill, one that you have to practice, one you have to train. But if we all listen better, we'd move forward a lot more than we are right now. Too much shouting.
Yeah, and, I tell my students another thing is that if you have three people talking to you once, who are you going to listen to? So establish yourself as a listener. If you want to be heard, make sure the other person, you are creating a space for them to be heard.
Yeah, and there is that, it's sort of been, made into something almost embarrassing by some of the New Age movements and so forth, the talking stick and passing a feather around or whatever. But there's truth in that.
Yeah.
A person should be able to speak until they've said everything that they have to say before anyone else chooses to respond. And in some of the native traditions, there was when I did the book on the Nez Perce were very fascinating people. You know, they're sort of the mountain people out west in where Oregon and Washington and Idaho come together. Plateau people, so they, as plateau people, they watch from above. They understand about things. So I saw that their way of understanding the world was very valuable for me to learn. And they had something called the language of the blanket, where when a discussion was taking place, and this was usually in the case of treaty negotiations or something, everyone had a blanket that they had over their shoulder, just over one shoulder. And if what they heard someone else said reflected what they felt needed to be heard, they'd take the blanket and wrap it around them and be over both shoulders. But if at the end of the time, once somebody had one shoulder still uncovered, the blanket wasn't pulled over, they said, okay, we're done negotiating right now. We have to go talk. Then they would go back and get together and see what it was that that person had to say that hadn't been heard. And this idea of letting other people say, you know, what it is that they have to say and hoping that perhaps that articulates what it is you have to say is a valuable tool. I mean, I remember I think it was in Neither Wolf Nor Dog, my first book about dealing with the native folks. I think Dan talks about it being goat talk, but, always butting against each other, but this, but that. And so I've tried hard to learn to be a listener. Don't always get it right. And, you know, but it's a skill, and I really admire those people who, well, there was one of the clans among the Ojibwe is the Crane Clan, and the Crane Clan are the people whose job it is to speak, and when necessary, but the reason that they value the crane is because it seldom makes a noise, but when it makes a noise, everyone listens. So I try to look at that as, okay, well, we have to sort of all try to be members of our own personal Crane Clan.
That's right. When you say something, make sure it's significant. Make sure it's something that comes from the heart, and make sure it's something that's going to potentially have an impact on those who choose to listen to it. I know Native American values have been a big part of your life, a big part of your interactions with everybody. And what were the Native American values that you admired that really you want people on Lone Dog Road, who read Lone Dog Road, to understand? Mm-hmm.
Well, the first thing that's really important to understand is I do not transgress. I do not claim to be Native. I do not have a Cherokee grandmother. My own grandmother's maiden name may have been Crowfoot without a W, but I would have liked to have trafficked in that and said that I had Native blood. I do not. I am not Native, and I'm well raised in an old Catholic tradition of, you have to be sort of initiated before you get the right to participate in certain ceremonies. And this sort of bled over into my understanding of how to deal with Native people, and that I am a guest on their land. I am a guest in their cultures. I do not have to like what I see, but I have to respect what I see. So I always have that as my sort of prologue, that I do not claim to be speaking as a Native person or for Native people. What I can speak from is what I see and what I learned. And the values, the primary value that I think almost all Native traditions have, you know, they're very different tribes, very different languages, very different ways of understanding things, but they all share this common belief that the world is a teacher and the spirit, there's spirit in everything. You know, we have this way of thinking that we are, you know, that we act upon the world. Their way of understanding is the world acts upon us, and we have to have humility in the face of what the world has to teach us. Animals teach us, weather teaches us, circumstances teach us, seasons teach us, other people teach us, but we're all learners because we're attentive to the outside world, and there is presence and spirit in everything. There's spirit in encounters, there's spirit in individual objects and individual beings. And this is so deeply embedded in their way of understanding that they don't necessarily, the young people that I worked with, for example, don't necessarily even understand this. They don't think about the fact that when the drum comes out or the pipe comes out, everyone offers it the sacred space and presence that it has. If I go into a room with a bunch of people and say, hey, let's us all get together and pray, half the people, myself included, are going to run for the exit. Don't ask me to pray with you. That's not my game. That's not the way I want to be. I don't want to be in some way coerced into that. But when you're dealing with a culture where spirituality is embedded into its very core, and someone brings out the drum and everyone gets around it, no one's going to talk. No one's going to violate the sacred space that's being created. The sense of the sacred in everything is the core value that meant the most to me. Other ones, I mentioned the valuation of the elder. This is in a lot of very traditional cultures, that the elder is, you know, that you ask the elder's advice, you ask the elder's understanding of things. You honor the elder as someone who's not vestigial. One of my friends, he had his two daughters with him, and they were at what the natives call a feast, you know, essentially just a big potluck, you know, and every sort of, you know, bags of potato chips, venison stew, you know, 7-Up, just laid on a Masonite tables. And they have feasts for all these different events. And in this case, we were standing there, and I don't know what the feast was for, but you've got the elders who are there, and a lot of them are pretty, you know, pretty beaten down in wheelchairs and not able to move much. Instead of our situation, like where we have a family dinner, everyone says, feed the kids first, get them out of the way, you know, stop. You know, they run up and grab the food and things. And even if they're held back, it's assumed that the kids sort of have a primacy. This man had his two daughters wait. And he set them up, and they went to the elders, asked if they could give them some food, went and got the food on the plate, brought it to them, went and got them their coffee or whatever, and stood by them while they ate. So if they needed anything, they would have someone to serve them. That was a value. I think the value that the native people like, they appreciate someone who gives respect, not someone who shows dominance. If America is off the rails right now, that's the problem. It's not about giving respect. Respect is sometimes seen as weakness. It's not weakness. It's absolute strength. And then lastly, I mean, there are many, but when I did the book on Chief Joseph, it was an incredible exercise for me. It took me 4 years to do that book, and I pretty much traveled the whole route of the Nez Perce exile, 4,000 miles, did it like 4 times, and I got to know those people very well. And I'd been sent out to do a book on Chief Joseph. And the assumption, probably very few of the listeners even have any thought of Chief Joseph other than maybe the knowledge that he walked forth and held out his rifle and said, from where the sun now stands, I shall fight no more forever. But that in itself wasn't even accurate. What was really important that was accurate is he was not a war chief. He was a camp chief, and he led from behind. He was the one whose job it was to make sure that all the women and children, if there was someone killed, the children had to be put with another family. He made sure there were no stragglers, that there were people that needed to be helped to get back on the trail. He helped from behind. He was sort of the caboose in a way. And that idea of leadership from behind was another one of the great values that I found in the Native people. So, I mean, it just goes on and on, but they're just a different sense of humility in the face of human interaction and a sense of spirituality and everything. And it seems so desperately lacking in us right now. It all has to do with heart, with something to do with caring rather than dominance. And yes. So it became a crusade of mine, but it certainly became a touchstone for me to try to tell about these values, tell it all these different ways. So that's been my task in life, is to try to, without appropriating anything, claiming to be anything more than I am, saying you people have something that I have learned and I need to share it with the broader audience because I've got a different audience than they do.
And, you know, most Native American values, they resonate with me. The fact that they work in harmony with nature. They see nature as having a living spirit, whether it's the stones, the rivers, the trees. They have reverence for human life. They have reverence for all creation. Four-leggeds, two-leggeds, you name it. They see spirit and value in everything. And I think you're right. You know, the other thing you mentioned about respect, I used to be an addictions counselor and a clinical supervisor, which seemed to be kind of like a previous lifetime ago. But the canon of ethics that governs our profession, and whether it's social work, whether it's counseling, is allowing individuals to self-determine their path and treatment, treating individuals with respect and dignity. And as you know, I just said, this has just occurred to me that those are values, our Native American values that are inherent in our ethical codes in terms of treating individuals who come to us with challenges with respect, and as if they have a voice and if they have value. And you're right, if we can transcend that to just about everything in society and everything in the world today, given the state of current events, the world would be a much harmonious place to live in. We would respect difference, but we would see similarities within that difference.
I mean, America's been built on an ethic of dominance and victory. We've got winners and losers. We don't think collectively very well. Once we start thinking collectively, then people immediately say, oh, you think like a communist or whatever sort of way of sort of reductionism that comes up with a political valuation of that sort of communality. But this binary reality of being part of a collective group or fighting for the individual is not good. I mean, we are a nation of individualists and individuality, and that gives us an incredible amount of creativity and problem solving. And I mean, we just, all of us have heard the stories about in World War II when, the lead person got killed, the strength of the American soldier was that the next person could step up and take over leadership. We have that capacity of creativity and problem solving. But when that is carried to the extent of each of us is meant to dominate over the other, or we're in a fight to win, it's unseemly. It's not a way to go. We need to work together. Everything's getting knitted together in a very, faster than we can imagine. It's getting knitted together in terms of communication skills, in terms of people traveling. And God knows it's getting knitted together in terms of things that are happening to the environment. And unless we figure out how to think collectively, how to feel collectively, and how to feel that the other person's situation is not only important, and it, even if you have to say, well, it impacts me to care about them, maybe that's the way in. But ultimately, making sure that no one's left behind, really, it's time for that. And remember, one of my strange relationships in life, out of neither wolf nor dog, came a friendship with Robert Plant, the musician. And he found the book, and without going into that whole story, we became friends over that book. And he read it, and he's one of those people that he walks down the street and it's all about him. He doesn't live that way, but he couldn't walk out in your street or my street and go a block without people stopping him. And he, out of all the things in Neither Wolf Nor Dog, came up with the fact that what we need to learn is that it's not from here to out there. It's from out there to here. And he actually used that gesture. He said that really meant something to him, that it's from out there to back here. We need to get a better grasp of the out there, and that's to do with that listening again, is to do with caring, is to do with, seeing that the world, that we're part of a larger world. And until we see that, this larger world is going to turn on us.
Exactly. And, there was an event, I don't know if you had heard about this or read about it, it was the Great Conjunction of 2020, and this occurred, I think, when Mars and Jupiter came together to form the Christmas star. And that hadn't happened in about 450 years. And the significance of that was a shift in our mindset where we were going to return to the age of Aquarius, that where inclusion, tolerance, respecting difference were going to be the norms rather than the exception. I think with any transition that occurs, in terms of civilization terms, It goes in phases, and I mean, you can throw the physical clock out the window for that, but the fact that that Mars and Jupiter came together, particularly during a time of division in our country, I thought was significant, and hopefully that really will get us to take the community out here and bring it within and become a part of the greater whole, as a part of just being looking out for our own individual interests. And that needs to change, Ken, or else I'd die as a society, but we're certainly going to flounder.
Well, hopefully, hopefully it's a sort of a chrysalis, And that this, you know, remember reading years ago, I forget the scientist, but about how everything had to break before it could be reconfigured.
Yep.
And hopefully breaking is not a fatal breaking, but the reconfiguration is got to take place. And, you know, and when I look at this, you know, people ask me, you know, I wrote a hopeful book in Lone Dog Road, but I'm not at heart a tremendously optimistic person. I've seen too much darkness in my life. I have too much sense of my own limitation to change things, and that the word progress, you know, it may be Obama's The Arc of Moral Justice or Martin Luther King's Arc of Moral Justice, but I don't feel it in my everyday life. But the thing that fascinates me, and I'm not even sure, you may have more insight into this than I do, but I'm very fascinated with the way young people are addressing the situation that they're growing up into. I don't know what it would be like to grow up in this world. I've got a son who's 35, and he teaches in a very high-powered high school. And he says that his generation, he can hardly recognize the 18-year-olds, the 16-year-olds that he's dealing with. But, I mean, they're growing up with, I've got inbred, ingrained senses of racial differentiation. I may want to overcome them, but it's not like I don't see race. I absolutely see race. I see, you know, different types of political warfare. I mean, we've all got our frame of reference that has been shaped over the years, and I'm not sure what the young people are seeing. If I were them, coming from where I come from as a child of the 60s, I'd be really pissed. I'd be pissed at everyone, and I don't know what I'd be doing, but I don't think I would be operating from, you know, greatness of spirit or magnanimity. And yet, the Native people that I've studied with, been with over the years, very often, they had that struggle, but the best of them operated from a sort of magnanimity of spirit, and that was what allowed them to survive under all the attempts to obliterate their culture over 500 years. I just don't know what it would be to be a young person these days. I mean, do you deal with them at all? Do you have any sense of what the young folks are about?
I deal mainly with college students. And I know one of the things that we've noticed and I've noticed with them is a greater sense of depression, anxiety. I think, one, because of the state of the world, because of the pressures they're feeling academically to succeed. I think many of them are not prepared for the transition from high school to college, which makes it much more difficult. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing, and I know you mentioned being fascinated or interested in children who are supposedly called neurodivergent. I'm not for those kind of labels anyway. I prefer children who look at the world from a multidimensional perspective,
right,
and can operate in simultaneous worlds at once. I think they're also faced with those challenges. And I think a lot of them, if they are that intuitive, see ahead and might see that, geez, I don't know if I want to be a part of this world anymore. Suicide tends to be a concern in that age group. I think it's the second leading cause of death in individuals 14 to 29. And it may be higher because there's some that aren't unreported. They're dealing, Kent, with challenges that as an 18-year-old, I never had to deal with. They're dealing with financial pressures. They're dealing with a lot of different, how do I fit in? If they're dealing with intuitive qualities that they feel other individuals won't understand, it's how do I fit into a society that may not be receptive to that? I think all of that, in addition to, I think, the state of the world today has an impact. I think that also weighs on the mind heavily of college students as well, too, which my philosophy in terms of dealing with my students is I want not only for them to learn, but to create an environment where they feel safe to be who they need to be for the time that they're with me because of the pressures that they're dealing with. I believe, and this has been an issue since I've been in human services, is a lack of resources. There's always more individuals that need help than there are resources to provide for that. I think they're facing many more challenges than we had to face when we were younger. And they're doing it in a world now that's not as forgiving.
Yeah. And I just think one of the things that kind of fascinating about you know, being a writer is that you broadcast, you know, to a large world. I said about that, what you're getting back, you don't know who those people are. but you are sort of seeing a marketplace of what it is that you've done that's significant. And I always looked at that cab driver story. Young people gravitated to that. My readership is, by and large, it's roughly my own demographic, maybe a little bit younger. I'm not a young person's writer, really. But that particular story fascinated everyone all around the world, versions of it everywhere. I mean, it's been probably millions of times it's been broadcast. And I've gotten responses back from it from young people. And I think the reason is when things are too large for us to deal with on a global sense, the idea that maybe some small act made a difference is encouraging. That maybe I live in this world, I can't do anything about this world, all the stuff that's going on, but if I can do something that helps one person or opens the eyes of one person, then you feel like somehow that there's a contribution there. You don't have to ask what the significance of it is in the larger sense, but you just, it's a providing hope. And maybe this sort of microscopic movement towards hope it would be easier if we lived in communities that didn't have all the communication that we have. But people do know what's going on everywhere around the world, the instantaneous communication. But if you can reduce it to the moments, to just the moments where one of the lines that I used is, we don't all live holy lives, but we live in lives that are alive with holy moments. And so maybe it will come to that, that people will have to say, I've got to turn out and I've got to tune out all the rest of this noise and just try to serve in the immediate moment that I have before me. I think that's probably what I'd do if I were a young person these days, if I didn't get swallowed up with my own anger and frustration.
Yeah, and I think the other thing with young adults too is they have so many different categories. They're brothers or sisters. They have families. They bring their histories into the classroom. There's a lot of challenges that they're dealing with that we may not even know about unless they tell us. Mm-hmm. So that's why I try to create an environment where it's safe, where they feel comfortable sharing and they feel comfortable learning. And one of the messages I give to my students is that if you think the world is ever going to be a better place without you, you think nobody's going to care if you leave this earth, know that there's going to be one person that's going to care, and that's going to be me. Because once you have been a student of mine, you've now become part of my extended family. And that's the other thing I like about Native American values is their kind of extended view of what family is. And that came out quite nicely in Lone Dog Road, particularly at the end where, family wasn't the family you were born into. It was the family that was created on the road.
More family than blood sometimes. Yeah. And when we talked about the different beliefs that I found important, that's one of them. We are so wedded to the nuclear family idea. And, it's a stone in the pond that the ripples go out from mom and dad, and then maybe it goes to grandma and grandpa or uncle and aunt. But gradually, the ripples seem to disappear. But from the first day that I was working with the Native people, Native kids, I'd have a student come in and I'd say, well, did you do your homework? And she'd say, no, I didn't go home last night. I mean, I remember this very specifically. And I said, wait, you didn't go home last night. And I had visions of out on the street, getting in all sorts of trouble. A kid, a teenager who says, I didn't go home last night is generally putting up a red flag of some sort. And mm-hmm. I said, what do you mean you didn't go home last night? She said, no, I went to my grandma's. I went to my auntie's. That was it. I went to my auntie because the aunt is another mother. And if you're not getting along with your own mother at that time, go to your other mother, go to the aunt and the uncle. I've talked about this with my son. The uncle's job in most traditional Native societies is to serve as the sort of moral shaper of the child. The assumption is the father is either too close to the child and is too lenient, or is too distant and too strict and doesn't have the proper intimacy they can model, but he can't necessarily counsel. And so the uncle's job is to be the counselor. And I've talked to my son about that with our nephews. And, this larger sense of family, grandma has a certain importance, that grandfather has, everybody has a role to play. And you can generalize that. You can generalize it out of the bloodline and say, everyone that you deal with on a day-to-day basis is your family. And you have to treat them as family. And families, as we know, There are people you don't like or don't get along with, people who you have a bad day with. But ultimately, at the bottom, the core is that you are part of something in common and you don't give it up. It's something that you're responsible for. And if we could just sort of build that into the package of our human understanding, we'd be a whole lot better off.
Yeah, and that extended understanding of family can translate into us being connected to something that's greater than we could have imagined.
Yeah, listen.
Ken, are there any last takeaways you want to leave with the readers from Lone Dog Road, or what else you want them to take away from the book?
Well, I guess I have a few basic things that I think I want to communicate to people that I've learned over the years. One is that people like people who like them. That if you want to get along with people, if you feel like, you know, everyone's afraid of being judged. We're all thinking, we're all looking and saying, what is that person thinking about me? If you're a terribly arrogant person, then, you know, maybe you don't care about being judged, but most of us are afraid of being judged. But ultimately, people like people who like them. So if you like people, you're going to connect with people. And liking people means listening to them and being interested in them. There's lesson number one. Lesson number two that I've said as a father is your child, just the two of you, and go on journeys from the time that child is young, because you'll build something into the relationship that will change and grow over the years, but will always be present in a way that you do things and know each other. Give respect rather than expecting respect.
Yes.
Listen, ultimately, and this is the hardest one, that on a micro level, it doesn't run a macro level. I won't even go down that hint. You're better off always trying to be kind.
Yes.
Kindness is good, but if you always try to be kind, you're going to get stepped on, you get used, people are going to use your kindness. You're not going to get ahead in this way that the world thinks of getting ahead. But ultimately, you never go wrong being kind. And I think that would probably be put on my tombstone if I had to. It's high risk, but on the long term, you never go wrong by being kind.
Absolutely. And being kind and coming from a position where you want to maintain peace and harmony and learn the value of compromise. Lone Dog Road's available on Amazon, all of the local bookstores as well throughout the country.
Yes, it should be right. It should be now and everywhere.
Yeah.
And I hope people will look for it. Yeah, for sure. I'm a writer. I need to make a living. That's what I do for a living. But ultimately, as a writer, I've always been a teacher. I think teachers have the most important job in the world. I know from the time that I taught, it was harder by a factor of 100 than writing is. Writing's a skill. Teaching is, you know, an art form that, you know, you don't get a moment's rest, but you're affecting people's lives. So I always look at my writing as teaching. And I hope people will get Lone Dog Road, the trilogy of Neither Wolf Nor Dog, The Wolf at Twilight, and The Girl Saying the Buffalo is a good introduction and a good journey through us. A non-Native person looking at the Native world and the values they have to offer and the experience they've had. But I kind of think that Lone Dog Road puts it all together. And I would ask people to read it, hopefully as not just a good story, but a good book is always about more than what it's about. And this is a book about human differences, human commonality, and it's a hopeful book and a book about redemption. And, you know, it's me paying my rent, and you helped me pay my rent by reading it. So please go look up Lone Dog Road. It's just out there, and it's a big one. It's a long one. If it doesn't worry, you can use it to shore up your table leg if necessary. If you can't get through it all, but it's a good book, and I appreciate you letting me talk about it.
It is. It's a great book, and certainly I think it ranks up there with your best work. Yeah, I saw a lot of references to the trilogy in your book. But it's just a great story about hope. It's a great story. There's so many great teaching moments, and your books always include teaching moments. And
that's what life is about.
Exactly. And also, you represent the Native culture in a way that's authentic, that's in their voices, and you take great pains to make sure that their traditions, their words are represented accurately. So Thank you for that. You are a bridge between Native and non-Native cultures, and I know you've been recognized by Native cultures and our society in general. Thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for spending some time with me today and sharing about the book, your journey, your thoughts, your philosophy. It was a pleasure having you on the program today, Kent.
Well, you're very kind to say that. Kindness is what it's all about. So thanks so much.
You're welcome. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.